Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, Brad.
Yes.
Do you know how we fund the program Going Off Track?
I know exactly how we fund it. There's one source of income for us, and that is patreon.com/goingofftrack, where our loving patrons give us money and we give them bonuses.
Patreon? Stop making up words. It's a great place. We do a weekly Thursday night fireside chat. Brad takes all the embarrassing things I say in podcasts that he doesn't put into podcasts and puts it on the Patreon. Funny pictures of Brad in the 90s, usually naked or wearing a wristband. Please sign up. Brad, what's the address?
Patreon.com/goingofftrack.
Brad, you ready to take a trip down memory lane with me?
I'm ready to go to Mars.
Yeah. Can you? This podcast goes all the way from the 12-year-old version of me to theoretically a person going to Mars by 2035.
Yeah.
I mean, that is an expansive podcast.
Multi-generational.
Yeah. But I was
from
so
you,
happy
to. From you playing football to your kids going to Mars.
I mean, come on.
That's what happens in this podcast, for real.
Yeah, this is like a Scorsese film in a podcast.
Exactly. You know?
And I'm not even going to be really old and pretend I'm young like De Niro. Didn't work. But anyway, this was a blast. I'd wanted to have Torsten on for a while. And it's just not every day that the guitar player of your first band becomes a spacecraft engineer for the Jet Propulsion Laboratory at NASA.
Can we just call him a rocket scientist? Because that's what he is.
Yeah. I mean, it's incredible. It's really like one of those, I always knew, you know, like we talked about in the interview, Torsten and I would see each other in LA, and I always knew he was doing stuff like this, and we'd always catch up. And then, you know, by like 2012... when I see he's like literally on this team, you know, putting a rover into space. And then, you know, just this last year, you know, being even further up in the team, leading the Perseverance rover to Mars. And, you know, he's been posting about it on his social medias. And it's just like so fascinating, not only how he got there, but just what the process is like now and the kind of mindset of someone who does that, you know? Something that became clear even from researching this interview and speaking to him is like, it might be similar to music, right? Where the people who excel in these fields kind of can maybe tap into a part of their brains that like a normal person can't.
Oh, absolutely. You know?
And the same thing that would drive, you know, a guitar player to, you know, practice his parts over and over again and make them perfect and add these tiny little dimensions here and there. You could so easily see how the same skill set could be put into engineering or something, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Focusing on something you're excited about, man.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, just to see him going from someone who, you know, built remote control cars to riding dirt bikes to like stealing his dad's Porsche, you know, like stuff like that. And just generally being like, you know, I don't know if you could pick up on it in the interview, Brad, but one of the coolest things about this guy is that he was always incredibly talented. You know what I mean?
Right.
And I think he had to know he was talented the whole time. You know, like it's not like he was doing things that other kids were doing, but you would literally never know about it.
Oh, yeah.
And that's one of the greatest things about it, you know, like you'll always find out by default. You'll be like, oh, Torsten was like a great tennis player. Oh, he was like a great dirt biker. Oh, he was a great guitar player. Oh, he wrote his own like electronic music and has a Bandcamp page, you know, but he always has this kind of like cool, chill modesty about him where he sort of accepts people, you know, exactly what they were. And, you know, I know this just came up a couple weeks ago in my like Toby Morris interview, but in the same way, Torsten's one of those people I just ran into at a super young age that made me feel really good about what we were doing. You know, right. He just made me feel like myself, like I could be myself. The house that his parents had, like I said in the interview, kind of had this philosophical ease to it that a lot of houses and parents we knew at that time just didn't have. You know, it was forward. And who knows if they didn't set up that kind of environment, if, you know, our first band even ever starts and blah, blah, blah.
The first living room band.
Exactly. Yeah, that's a memory about it. The confabulation that I completely
We're a living room band. Oh, we come from living room land.
Yes, Brad. That's good. So, yeah, I mean, what a crazy story. I just was like, I don't know, fascinated to talk to Torsten now and find out what the hell's going on out there, you know?
It's a fun convo.
Let's say, do you have any, like, do you have any interest in going to space?
No.
None?
No.
Hard no.
Yeah, I'm not, no, I don't. I'm not, I've never have either. And I don't think, like, I don't think it's fear. I mean, maybe now it is. I'm like, you know, I'm old enough, I don't need to go to space.
Oh, I can't handle a G-force anymore.
But, I think I always kind of realized that it's just, it's a big fucking sacrifice to get there. You know what I mean?
Yeah, right. Sure.
Like, I mean, yeah, maybe in 40 years, all you'll have to be is rich. But
right.
Ever just since I've been alive, it's like, you know, I knew when I was, you know, 12 years old that the guy that to be an astronaut, you had to be not only be the cream of the crop, but fucking work your ass off.
Yeah, right. You know? I mean, even just that simple fact, they said, what, a person who would eventually go to Mars, I mean, it'll be 2 years at least before you even ever saw that person again.
Yeah, exactly. I'd never had that commitment for getting off the planet. Although I would, I've always been enamored by the idea of anti-gravity, of being able to experience that at some point.
That would be fun. We got to somehow, maybe as Torsten goes higher up in JPL, we can convince him to toss us into one of those
planes,
those pressure chambers.
Oh, but that's not anti-gravity though. That's
oh, right.
That's just fucking cold as hell.
Oh yeah. I think we could get into one of those anti-gravity things then. It's crazy though. And it made me think, I wish I was able to ask that pale blue dot question a little more eloquently. I realize I was kind of stumbling as I said it, but I really do think, you know, once we have a chance to look back on this time and reflect on what the fuck is actually going on, there really seems to be some causation to me between this image appearing in, I think, like the early to mid 90s of the Earth from a great distance, really seeing like, you know, this fleck of dust amidst the galaxy, and then Carl Sagan writing this thing that essentially like all of our earthly minutiae is just part of this tiny speck and you really shouldn't think about it like that. This has to have some kind of fallout to what we're dealing with now, because if there's anything like, I mean, there's a lot of things religion does and this could turn into a long intro, but it also, it makes people feel mutually exclusive. Right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like it makes people feel self-important. It makes you feel like there's someone watching your life and the moves you make are worthwhile. And when you match that Psyche with the pale blue dot, I think you're almost like slamming people with an existential problem that they are not prepared for. And it, I think it has something to do with the way like our minds and our society is coping with it right now, because we're kind of in this like post-religion, I hope, neo-contemporary society that's moving in some kind of way. And I think the 25 to 30 years of fallout from that photo like have something to do with it. I'm just not smart enough or researched enough to put it on paper or or act on anything more than instinct and anecdotal evidence. But I do think there's something to it. Do you think there's something to it?
I think it definitely had an impression on you, Benny, for sure.
Thanks, Brad. Leave it to the son of a biblical archaeologist to just take you down a peg, you know? Good for you. We had a good 90 minutes with Torsten. You wanna dig into this?
Let's go.
It's going on track.
3, 2, 1.
Don't fuck around, Brad. I was just Torsten, just before this, I was texting Brad because we had assumed you would jump in and jump out because you're a scientist and you needed to check that it would work first. And
oh, yeah.
I was like, Brad, he said there's a robot drone hovering outside my window. And I said, listen, Torsten could definitely vaporize us from space if he wanted to. At least he knows a guy, you know?
Yeah. Just make sure you stay on my good side, you know? Yeah. So
I'll mince my words. So what's up, man?
Yeah.
I'm so glad you could come on.
Oh, thanks, man. Thanks for having me. It's good to hear your voice. And lots of exciting stuff happening here. So
when's the actual physical last time we spoke? Was it like in person in LA somewhere?
Probably in LA, yeah. I think maybe it was definitely when you were touring and coming through here. I think we probably spoke on the phone one time and crossed paths, but weren't able to meet up. Probably like one of the last times, but it would have been years. So, but yeah, man, we've been in contact a little bit in email space and in other ways. So I feel connected, you know?
Oh, always. Real friends always poke their heads around. You know, you don't have to talk to them all the time. You know that you'll get to it eventually.
Well, bandmates, you guys were in a band, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
Literally like my entry into all of it, you know, was this band, like, and this group of guys. So this is a good place to start. Torsten, are you familiar with the term confabulation?
I have a good idea what it is. It's kind of mixing a couple things together, right? And just kind of mixing things up.
That's right.
Right?
So it's essentially like when you go further and further away from a memory that your brain does a natural I don't know what you'd even call it, but it naturally fills in the gaps with something that just makes sense. That's something that you can assume took place, or a person you assume did something. And then you tell yourself that enough and it becomes the actual story due to a gap in memory, not because you're intentionally fabricating it. So that being said, I've told the story about me like entering Dilemma, which was our band. I believe X Dilemma X for a short time because of John Mopper. And I want to see if my memory of it matches up with your memory or if I'm suffering from confabulation. Okay.
This will be a fun game.
Yeah. Okay. So here's my, like, I wrote down my general, you know, not too deep, but my general gist of what happened. I remember Nick Park of the legendary Park family in Bradley Gardens being your drummer. John Mopper saw me in a Nirvana t-shirt in school and heard I played drums. Apparently Nick Park wasn't working out. So I came to Joe Alessandra's house. I don't know if I brought my drum set or not. Certainly didn't have a car. And I tried out Come As You Are by Nirvana to get entry into the band. Then I remember our first show being at Bill Farrington's house, who was in a Nirvana cover band called Verse Chorus Verse. I remember they played, and then we played our three songs, which was Operation Liberation, A-Bomb by SNFU, and Bro Him by Pennywise. And then Verse Chorus Verse started playing again, and the people there asked us to play our mini three-song set again. So this is like my general, hopefully non-confabulated memory of how that came to pass. Is it similar to yours? What did I fill in or not?
You know, Ben, this is going to be interesting because we don't have like a ground truth, right? Like it's just my confabulations versus yours. Yes. At this point, you know?
But two confabulations could lead us to a little bit of a push towards science, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It's you know, there's a statistical element there that right. is that you know, if we do have corroborating stories, right, then
right.
there's a higher chance of it actually being reality. But that was actually remarkably accurate and something that I haven't thought about in so long, you know. So okay. So a couple things though, that might be the case that you tried out at Joe Alexander's house. I can't remember that. Like yeah. the earliest memory I have of us playing was actually in my living room.
Oh, okay. Oh my God.
Do you remember
yeah.
that?
Yeah.
I feel like we were there before, you know, at my house before we went to Joe's.
I think so, actually. And then when it got kind of like full bandy, it went to Joe's basement.
Uh-huh.
Wow. Yeah. That is true. I forgot that. So we started as like a living room band, not even a basement band.
Yeah, we were like on carpet in the living room,
right?
You know, basically like 13 years old. And,
yeah. Was there yeah. a drum set at your house?
No, you brought yours,
okay.
I think.
Man,
or,
so
yeah. Yeah.
That must have been my mom in the Ford Tempo.
Definitely. Yeah.
Wow. Okay. So that
how is this going to be interesting for anybody else besides for me and you, Ben?
Oh, Torsten, doesn't this is called going off track. I'm not yeah. working for anyone here. You know, like this is, yeah. I just wanted to have you. I mean, this is fascinating to me. I mean, we talked about this a little on the last episode too, and it's, I really find this stuff fascinating, especially these days and now raising kids, is like, you know, when you really think back to like the minutiae of certain things and how little, you know, just little turns one way or the other, a little passing with somebody one way or the other really set your course, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So when I started, you know, uncovering this, I realized again, you know, like you, I hadn't really peeled back the onion of this in so long, and then realized just really how formative it was for me, you know,
mm-hmm.
you know, meeting all of you and starting down that path, because booking dilemma shows is how I started booking shows, which
yeah.
turned into like a very serious thing for me and kind of basically set me on the path of the music industry. So
yeah. And, you know, when I look back to that time, Ben, and, you know, and I think about, you know, the dynamic and our band and what you brought to the table is, honestly, you're a horrible drummer.
It's true. It's true.
And, but what you did was you were an incredible networker, you know, and uh-huh. you just had a way to make friends with everybody and to foster those relationships and to generate opportunities and all those things.
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting. You, now that you say that, I guess the drums caught up.
Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, kinda.
Right. Like, cause I mean, I listen, like, yeah. Torsten's not lying. Okay.
Yeah.
When I listened to this Dilemma demo, which to us was like the peak of recording quality. I mean, we really, for a band recording a six song cassette at the time, I mean, we actually went to a real studio. We actually had a layout printed. Like, it was like as close to an official demo release as you can get. And the drums on that are insane. Like, I literally just did not know how to play a straight beat at all. And when I try, you can hear me painfully trying. And I remember the trick, because you guys had unusually large amplifiers for our age. And I remember, like, no one could hear me. And you guys were always just like, yo, hit harder. But then we came up with, like, some scheme that I could play the same exact terrible beat, but make the China cymbal, like, the lead cymbal, which is, yeah, you know, like, the most... Brad here is a recording engineer, so he probably just shuddered when I said that. And I'll never forget, yeah, when we went to this, was it, like, the Pinebrook Studios to record that demo.
God, your memory, dude. How did you not remember that name?
You know,
wait, let me guess. The engineer took away your ride.
I wouldn't let him. This is where Torsten's story adds up. I was already, like, kind of a dick who, like, thought I knew exactly what I needed. So I showed up to this studio. I'll always remember the studio because famously Mike Judge had recorded there. Not in Judge, but in Mike Judge and Old Smoke, which was his, like, weird blues album he tried to make afterwards. And we went up to that studio. I had no idea how to change heads or tune drums. So I had lined the inside of my drums with, like, egg crate, like bedding, and put the heads on. So literally my drums just sounded like dead bodies. You know what I mean? Like, no ringing or resonance whatsoever. And then half the songs, I'm also riding the China cymbal. And I kind of remember this guy giving me attitude and me just being like, yeah, I don't know, man. Just got to deal with it. It's the way I want it. Yeah. Like walked in like Bernard Purdy or something, you know? Mm-hmm. But what are you going to do? You did did you have a Flying V and a 5150?
Joey had the 5150. Right. And I had the 4x10 Fender Bassman.
Okay.
Yeah, for the amp. And cranked, you know, all the way to try and play over Joey.
Yeah, and, right. Yeah,
he was right. And you know, for no reason, he was an awesome guitarist.
Yes.
And you know, just because that's the way it was when you were a kid. But yet I just remember the engineer just being a total drunk, man.
Oh yeah. Yeah, he was bad.
You know?
I think if I had a better sense of the world and people at that point, I definitely would not have gotten along with that person. But
yeah,
since I was like 13 and thought I was walking into like the Metallica Nothing Else Matters video, you know, like he was put on a pedestal regardless. This was an adult who owned a recording studio, which was basically like some version of a demigod to me at the time.
You know? Yeah. Yeah. Well, back then it's just like, that was the only game in town, you know. That's it's right. Like, there was no laptops and digital recording interfaces and, you know, all the technology that we just like enjoy and just is incredible these days for doing your own stuff. But like, you know, you had to go and you had to do a reel to reel and, yeah, you know, and it was all analog, you know?
Yeah, it's interesting. Like when I think back, you know, I really like met you and got to know you around that time, even though we lived really close together for a while.
Yeah.
And, you know, by the time I met you, you were already playing guitar, already into skateboarding. You were already like fucking around with your dad's cars, already fucking around with the motorcycle. Like,
yeah,
what, you know, when I think back, you know, you had this like really broad understanding of a lot of things at a young age. Like, can you remember when that curiosity for everything started and how,
oh geez,
how you almost like had the time for all of it? Cause I think of like a 14-year-old kid who is already proficient at a bunch of different things, you know?
Oh yeah. Thanks, Benny. Yeah. I mean, like, honestly, I remember there was this like little park by our house, and I remember like just like playing around. And by the way, you know, we used to play football when we were really young as neighborhood kids.
Right. Okay. We played some tackle in Rolling Knolls Park.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. So, okay. so, you know, we go back, man.
You did it.
You know? I think 8 years old, just neighborhood kids.
Can you imagine, Torsten, our friendship has survived neighborhood football games, being in a band together, and a 3,000 mile relationship for like 20 years? Like, I think you're stuck with me, bud.
Oh man, God, what the fuck did I do to deserve this shit, man? And now it's like I'm taking time out of my work day and just shooting the shit with you guys.
People asking something, I know.
Yeah, damn. I got to pay you back for all those free tickets to the Palladium and right, stuff like that. Right. So, as far as interest go, I think it's just kind of like, if I really look back at my life and give you a serious answer for how, you know, I kind of had the time, like it's a little bit of a neurosis with me. Mm. It's a problem actually, because like, I really have a problem like resting, you know, right. as you know, that sounds kind of weird, but it's like, I'm just inherently such a person who is so unhappy, sedentary, you know? And yeah. like, so I just like, I'm just always doing something and like burning the candle at both ends and not really. So there's a lot of freaking time in life. And the other thing, not to get too preachy here, but it's like one thing I just told somebody who kind of said something similar to me about, you know, like, how did you kind of get into all this stuff and develop these different skills? And it's like, so many people I feel like now, and, you know, are just like, they just bounce back and forth from one thing to another on short timescales, you know? Mm. And like, if you can just like chill and focus on one thing for six months, you know, like you'd be surprised how far you can get with that kind of devotion.
Right. Something. It's like people have like, they're like proud of, like a general surface knowledge of many things, but don't really dig in. You think that's just like, you know, maybe the culmination of, you know, social media and internet culture, when anybody has access to everything, and delineation between like an expert and an amateur is maybe like a little harder to find.
Yeah. I definitely think, you know, it's been said before, but you know, it definitely is an attention span type of thing, you know? And I think it was going on before social media and like kind of a trend towards that, even without it, but that definitely hasn't made anything any better in that respect.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
So, but it's really just about like, if you just devote to something and you put all your energy into it for an appreciable amount of time, whether that's 6 months or a year or 3 months for whatever it is, like you really can, you'd be surprised how far you can get with something with just the focus, you know?
When you do that stuff, do you have a tendency to like get bored with it after you master it, and it's like, okay, now's the next thing?
I do. I would say that, like, especially when, for me, I mean, it's my own fault. I would say I'm like good at a lot of things, but I'm great at nothing, you know?
Well, I mean,
and I think there is a point where I start to, once there's diminishing returns, like even myself, I do get antsy and wanting to move to the next thing.
Yeah. So even you have to tell yourself, no, like stick with it.
Yeah. It's a struggle, you know, like, yeah, I mean, just recently, I mean, that's like, you know, I was like really into cycling for like the past 5 or 6 years.
And all right.
It's just like, and it's like, I got to a point where I was just like, plateauing on it. And I just felt like I wasn't willing to take it any farther to really get to the next level and not willing to make that commitment. So I've kind of been focusing on other things. And that's an area I think where I've like shown a lot of consistency and a lot of work towards that I've kind of not abandoned, but just deprioritized.
Or did you just step up to superbike racing?
That's more of a return. That's like a midlife crisis, you know, like more than anything. So.
Right. I was telling Brad before what you're up to. He's like, those things go 140 to 160. Goodness.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, they're insane. Like the only, oh man, we're all over the place right now, but I'm just like, yeah, I mean, they're just like, they are crazy fun. Like the only way I can describe it is like, you know, like when you were a kid watching Star Wars and they're like right. zooming around on those little white things in the Ewok village through the forest. Yeah. Like it's the closest thing you can get to one of those things, you
right,
know?
Right.
So,
well, the thing that shocked me when you're, well, there's two things about what you were saying yesterday. It shocked me. A was that the straightaways when you're going 140 miles an hour or when you're resting. And then mm-hmm. I needed you to actually explain to me, like, You said holding on to something with a 0 to 60 of a tilde 2.5 S is a lot of force. I even Googled it and I couldn't figure out what that meant. What's that mean?
0 to 60 miles per hour in 2.5 seconds.
Oh,
and approximate.
I should have.
Yeah, no, that's my engineer.
I should have figured brain. That one out.
Yeah, no, it's all right. It's all right. Jeez, Ben, come on.
No.
Yeah,
I know. Yeah. My education stopped in like 1997. So,
man, yeah.
The trick is keeping that front wheel down at that.
And just holding on to the thing. It's just, it's crazy physical. It's super fun, but it's a weird thing, man. Weird thing that I do. And it's not really super, I guess, you know, I've always been a speed demon and stuff, but it's not really, I wouldn't say it's like super congruent or symmetric with my life. It's just this oddball thing that I got into and enjoy. But
and are you actually racing?
I was. I actually was a professional until I was 25. So I started when I was 19. It took me about 4 years working up through the ranks and kind of winning and doing pretty well on like a club level. Eventually I got my pro racing license and then I was racing in nationals for 2 years and placing like top 20, at least on the US level. And so I was super into it, but I stopped right around, when I was 26 to go to grad school. Cause it was just like a drug addiction. It was like, you know, it was like, it's like, I had a good job. I was like an engineer and like every year I had like a little less money and I was like eating ramen, like just trying to support the habit.
right.
And it just got to be to the point where I was just like, you know, like this is a lot and I need to go to like a therapy session to wean off this, you know?
Is there a serious like professional level to it or are the people lifelong dedicated to it really just dedicated to it for the sport?
Well, I would say it's much smaller in the US. So in the US, but still the top people in the US, still at I would say the top five professional athletes are still making seven figures a year. But on the world level, it's huge. It's like Formula One. You're talking about eight figure salaries for the top people in the world. Like they're making like, they're Kobe Bryant salaries. Like,
and what are the biggest countries for that?
Italy, Spain. Those are like probably the two biggest areas, where you get folks, England. So it's like a lot of, it's really big in Europe and you get like, you get some, Asian talent as well. Southeast Asia, Japan, Brazil. There's pro riders from all those places. And there's, you know, this is like, and now there's starting to be US again. US traditionally have had people on the world level, but there's been a drought the last couple of years. And now there's starting to be some younger riders that are starting to filter into the world level and are doing pretty well. So it's good to see. But anyhow, yeah.
So what was your machine, dude?
Oh man. as far as like what I used to race or right now?
Yeah, what were you riding?
I was riding two different bikes over my career. It was a Yamaha R6 super sport bike and then a GSXR 600. So those were they were like super sport level bikes. It basically is, it's not unlimited modifications. And cause I could not afford that spending all the money that I was doing, I needed to like basically race in like a tier down level just to manage the costs,
right.
You know, but like, it was still like, like it's super, you know, competitive and prestigious, almost more competitive, a little bit more about rider than just machine and money that you throw
right,
at it.
Right.
So,
right.
How much was
I used to ride and I realized that, you know, that motorcycles a long time ago kind of reached the maximum power that you could, you know, keep them on the ground, like keep that front wheel down. Uh-huh. You know, you talk about going from 0 to 60 in 2 seconds and you can't go any faster. You can't do it any quicker because you'll flip over backwards, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And now it's really just how fast can you go from 100 to 160?
Right. That's the other thing I realized that really what defined a killer bike, I got on a Ducati one time and was cruising through the countryside doing about 60. And I thought, wow, I wonder how quickly I could get to 90. And by the time that thought was out of my head, I was going 90 miles an hour. And I thought, oh, that's how fast. That's the difference between a fucking sick bike and a bike is not one that goes from 0 to 60 in 3 seconds, but one that goes from 60 to 90 in like 1 second.
Yeah. Yeah. It's they're just such insane machines, like power to weight, to give you an idea, on the, you know, the leader class bikes these days, you can be going 80 on the highway and, you know, gas it, dump the clutch and the rear wheel will spin, you know, looking for traction. Like, think about that. You know, it's like they're death traps, man. They have no place on public roads.
Right.
You
know? Yeah.
Yeah. In my opinion, you know, I mean, it's fine. People do whatever you want, you know, but for me, like I have no interest in riding those kind of machines on public roads. Like that's why I do close course stuff. You know?
Yeah. Right. Yeah. That makes sense. What would it take, like engineering wise, say you wanted to get a bike to go up to 200 miles an hour? What would you have to do to it so it wouldn't flip?
Oh, it's all these days. The electronics are insane. They have accelerometers. They have sensors on the wheels to measure wheel spin. Oh, and you've got like a lot of active electronics that are helping the pilot control the bikes and what the horsepower they produce. So there's tons of work and development. And that's like the biggest difference, you know, for Brad, you know, like the bikes that I used to ride, that probably you used to ride, they didn't have any of that stuff. And these days they've just increased the horsepower. They're way more capable, but they have electronic assistance to help you manage that.
That's crazy. Did you do all the work on your bikes yourself when you were full into it?
No, when I was into it, we had a crew chief on the team.
Oh, wow.
So it was like, it was a team with a mechanic and, who volunteered a lot of his time. And, one of the people in my life that has been probably the most generous, you know, as a guy by the name of Dominic Medina. And he's the stuff that he's put up and done, you know, for me, and I still maintain a relationship with him, to this day, but it was, But I mean, for the most part right now, you know, I do most of the work all myself and, it just helps.
You know? Yeah. I saw a quote from, another story about you, where you said a lot of the people that I love that are very brilliant have never turned a wrench before, where it's very theoretical and math based. Do you I mean, it's obvious you think that way, but there's like, how much of an advantage do you have in your field now because of so much of your physical background?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's it's definitely something that helps. It's just because, you know, engineers, they really have, we're balancing this all the time, but it's like, there's really a tendency for over-conservatism and protectiveness in a design. And nobody wants their piece or their function to fail. And therefore they hold on to a lot of margin a lot of times, more than's needed, or more conservatism in a design that can manifest itself in any number of different ways.
Yeah.
And being able to sniff that out, I think having a physical sense for what does 40 Newton meters feel like, for instance, so you're going to stand up and tell me this part's going to break at 40 Newton meters. Like I can see this thing, you know, I mean, there's like computers and stuff to help you with programs that help you with like structural analysis and things like that. But it gives you a certain, I would say, spidey sense to try and tease out weight and over-conservatism in design, just with like the physical reality of knowing that type, those type of things.
So it's almost like you almost have the ability to see this machine at its maximum, like mm-hmm. because you've been there before and you know what the actual parts can handle, like that kind of vibe.
Yeah, it's just about, you know, design margins and right. And things like that, and being able to try and kind of sniff out places and things that might not have enough, or which is usually more rare, or where they're holding too much.
Yeah. Totally.
Yeah.
I mean, it's interesting because I read about, you know, the machines you're making and how, you know, you have to ensure that, you know, this machine's going to be operational for 2 years without mm-hmm. any service, right? Without a person touching it. So mm-hmm. I have to imagine that there is like a big call for to be as careful as possible. So how can you gauge, is that where like a team comes in, like working with other people, how you can gauge like what's the absolute max you can get out of this stuff?
Oh, I mean, yeah, it's a huge team. Can I just ask the question? I mean, does everybody know what I do?
Oh, we're going to do like intros and outros for, yeah, for the episode. So I'm going to give you the full, like the full grand tour of who you are.
I see. Okay. Yeah. All right. Got it. I wasn't sure whether we had that background. But
it's good. We're a little casual here, though. It's good that you're looking out for us.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah.
Smart.
I can just see everybody listening just being like, who the fuck is this guy?
Motorcycle rider, guitar player.
Yeah. It's like, what is this dude? Yeah. It's like, yeah, he's like the dude down the street from Ben, you know? Let's see here. Question. Yeah. Big team. Definitely. And that's part of the problem, right? When you work on something that has this many components, right. and really where no one person can wrap their mind around the whole thing. And you've basically got siloed areas that are working on different components and different designs.
Right.
That's where I come in. And you can think of me in my job as a synapse in a brain rather than a node. So I will never know as much about a singular thing on the rover than somebody who's a node for that particular component.
Uh-huh.
But what I do have is the right skill set to understand, to absorb what's happening at that node, and then to relay that information to other places that need that, and to try and look across the design and all these nodes to try and optimize or help in the decision making, because the nodes don't have the broader view of what's going on to be able sometimes to make the right decision for the whole vehicle.
Interesting. So are you actually part of the like the initial design prior to build?
Yeah. So this mission, Perseverance, was kind of different for me in that I came on much earlier than I ever have on previous missions. So like on Curiosity, which was the previous rover in 2012, I kind of came on when we had already done a lot of the design and actually started to build like the box level components. And I came on as like a tester where I was looking for problems and starting to use all those components, what they call on a system level and a test bed. So that's where I came on for Curiosity. Now forward in time, after we landed Curiosity and we started to get really into the details on the next one, I came on about six years before we launched Perseverance. And we were still in conceptual phases at that point. Like the rover actually didn't even look like it did right now. We had two robotic arms on the front. There was details that are way different just from an architectural standpoint than where we've actually settled. Right. So I was actually part of like a lot of the chief engineer sessions where we were like whiteboarding and trying to make the right decisions on like the just the basic architecture of this vehicle.
Yeah.
So I did come on during design and influence certain components there. In addition, right after that, there's also another phase where you're actually developing requirements. So like, for instance, like on this mission, we wanted to grab cores, right?
Right.
Well, what does that mean actually? What does that core look like? What's valuable for science, right? Like how big does it have to be? How much mass? How deep do you want to go? How much fracturization can you guys take in that sample and have it actually still be scientifically valid? Do you guys want to look at the magnetic history of that thing? You know, and because if we like generate too much EMF with our radios and it scrambles the magnetic signature of those samples, like how much can you actually take? How many Tesla?
So you're working with like geologists, you're working with
totally
chemists, like all sorts of people. Yeah.
Top planetary geologists and you know, Caltech tenured professors, you know, you name it. And really to define what success meant and to make sure that essentially they're our customer and making sure that what we're building as robotics engineers is meeting their needs.
Huh.
So that's how early I was on this mission is very development of stuff like that.
When you're in like the initial concepts of it, is any of your design stuff like artistic and aesthetic by default? Like where, you know, I know you have the engineering component where you're thinking exactly what you need to do, but in how to apply it, like how much artistry is in that? And how much are you like looking to different people's robots and other people like in your scene or whatever?
Yeah. So I can say that the only artistry in this is elegance and simplicity. There's an artistry in simplistic design, right?
Right.
And making things as least complicated and robust as you can possibly make it. But aesthetically, there is zero. You know,
right.
It is literally just totally based in functionality and really in really rooted in at the end of the day, you know, being as light as possible. 'Cause there's whatever makes it on the rover, which is the component that I worked on. You can imagine the whole mission was a lot of different components. You had the descent stage, which was the rocket jetpack that took it to the surface. You got the cruise stage. You've got the capsule, all these things. Well, if you put another, you know, kilogram on the rover, it means we've got to put another 10 kilograms of fuel on the descent stage.
Right.
And then those tanks have to get bigger. And then all of a sudden the tanks have to get bigger on the cruise stage. So there's like a butterfly effect. Anything we actually get onto the surface just grams, like just balloon all the way back to the launch vehicle.
Right.
And so it is super, not frivolous, I would say, and bare bones.
Do you have like a mock environmental Mars?
Yes, we do, but there are certain things that we will never be able to do.
What's that?
Gravity.
Okay, right.
Yeah, so we never can simulate a Martian gravity environment.
Okay.
Which is challenging. But what we can do is we have huge vacuum chambers. And these are really expensive tests, so it's not like we do these things all the time. It's like they're kind of like targeted events in the development of the mission.
Okay.
But they're huge tanks and we suck out all the air and get it to Martian pressure, which is a very, very thin atmosphere.
Okay.
And then we pump a liquid nitrogen through the tank shrouds and that brings it down to like a representative Martian temperature,
which
like
is what?
minus 120 C. Generally is where we qualify things to, which is super cold, right?
Yeah.
Just to give you an idea, when we're doing these tests, that there are two liquid nitrogen trucks, those big semis that show up on the hour to refill our liquid nitrogen and to replenish it. And so, and if you're testing for 3 weeks, 24 hours a day, you can imagine, like, just on that level, this test starts to get really expensive, right? And all the engineers, so you can't just go and do this willy-nilly. They're like, but yeah, so, you know, to answer your original question is we do our best to simulate things. There are certain things that we cannot get around, the biggest of which is being the gravity environment.
Now, so, if you took to illustrate what the gravity environment is like say you figured out my air and temperature situation, which is obviously a situation, but we'll go past that. Like how would my body move on like the Martian surface?
You would be feeling very good. Because you're, you know, the gravity is 1/3 of okay. Earth. So you'd be jumping like Michael Jordan, man.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah.
Oh man, I got to get in that pressure tank and throw some down.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, man. Yeah. Just, yeah, I know, by the way, if you don't know, like when Ben was a kid, he was huge into basketball, you know, persistent, but
any listener of this podcast certainly knows I am still a fucking huge nerd about basketball. I'm a Brooklyn Nets season ticket holder. I just won a fantasy league on the back of Facundo Campazzo. So yeah, I'm still a fucking pretty big nerd about it. So you and your team, you know, the initial team in 12, you were the first ones in the history of Earth, right, to send something to Mars and it not be destroyed in travel or on the surface, right? Or the first thing to land on the surface that didn't get destroyed?
Yeah, I will. Let me modify that statement slightly. So we actually had, we did a lander. This was all, you know, basically the lineage of our team at JPL. You know, so JPL stands as the only organization to successfully land a vehicle on Mars and another planet.
Right.
Just in general. So we're the only team to have done that in human history. That's kind of claim to fame. So Russia actually sent something. It survived for a few seconds of transmission and then died. So they kind of, I guess, refute that claim a little bit. But honestly, I don't think that that's considered a success, personally. So no offense to, or I don't know, offense to Russia, I guess. You know what? Here's the thing though, is we landed something successfully. Like, I think it was like in 76, it was Viking. It was just a lander, right? And then in 1997, we did a Pathfinder, which was just like a tiny little RC car type rover.
Okay.
And then in the mid 2000s, we did Spirit and Opportunity, which were kind of like ATV sized rovers.
Right.
And then the mission that I worked on was this Jeep size ton megalith robot that landed in 2012, and that was Curiosity. So I and my team weren't the first people to put something and have it work on Mars.
But gotcha.
The organization that I work for is in fact the only folks to be able to do that.
Well, you're being modest. I'm gonna tell everyone that my friend is one of the few on Earth who can make this claim. I was wondering, is there a scene, and are you like a rock star in that scene? Like, are there young, you know, interns who come into JPL who are like, oh shit, that's Torsten Zorn. He was this guy in this thing, you know, like the way I would look at, you know, like Zach De La Roca or Bill Stevenson or something.
Sure. Yeah, there is, but I'm not on that level yet.
No.
You know, so yeah, I mean, I've got, you know, I'm doing okay. Like I'm actually, you know, I'd like to pat myself on the back you know, I'm a pretty major player in this stuff and I've built a good reputation doing good work. And, you know, definitely I feel good about my rep, but like, but you know, there's guys that are like that are just kind of like, you know, Illuminati. In NASA and JPL,
right.
You know, that are like older dudes, like this guy was like, you know, major dude on Apollo program or, you know, whatever, you know, there's guys like Gentry Lee who, you know, these are older gentlemen that are like rock stars. He's got a crazy story about how he just made this deal, you know, with NASA that nobody thought was going to come to fruition. And he was like, proposed this project and ended up winning the bid. And the deal was that he'd be project manager, but he was like 30 years old. You know what I mean? Wow. He was like a new person in the career. And all of a sudden he just got catapulted into project manager from like being a kid, you know? Right, and that's how he started his career. And he like authored books with Carl Sagan and stuff like that. And so there are people at JPL that are like that, and they're called fellows. Mm-hmm. But I'm not there yet.
So you're not getting invited to like the secret campouts in Colorado yet, or the
I can't comment. I got some things, you know. I got some things that I'm involved with, but you know, but it's you know, they're for the record, you know, I'm not on that level.
Yeah. maybe next rover.
Yeah, totally.
Since you brought up Carl Sagan, I actually had a question about that, which was, you know, I've always liked the concept of the pale blue dot, and, you know, I don't know, just like potentially what that photo may have done for human history in a lot of ways. And I had had a thought recently, especially when I had kids, that, you know, if spirituality changed post 1994, once they got this image, like just the simple concept that all earthlings can now see our entire existence of the planet in such a finite and like minute way, I feel like there was no other path than that had to change spirituality because of how people were seeing stuff now. And I wonder what you think about that and how introducing such a concept to like a kid, you know, showing you that you are just this tiny piece of an infinite system, is teaching that to a kid like okay when you're not teaching them like any spirituality, because it's kind of scary for some people to swallow. I just wanted to know what you think about that.
Whew. I mean, I would have to say, again, this is, you know, this is touching on something that is, you know, a personal thing, you know, and sure. I'm no more an expert on these kind of matters than anybody else, you know, and
agree to disagree.
But I mean, I think it's okay and necessary. But I think it's key to say that, with that is to give the full story here, that there is nothing that science has discovered, you know, that has discredited anybody's spiritual beliefs.
Right.
Right. Uh-huh. Like there is nothing that we have discovered that has proven beyond a shadow of doubt that there isn't another power or another force or something higher. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. And in my belief, you know, although I tend to be, I would say I'm an atheist, you know, my personal choice,
sure.
But I would say that, you know, that it's important to, for people to understand that the science and what we're finding, and, you know, your example of the pale blue dot, you know, it's not attempting to discredit that. I mean, you could a lot of times in a lot of ways say it's like, we're just trying to get closer, and that's human nature, you know? Mm.
And so now in your field, like, do you find, you know, your colleagues to be like generally agnostic and atheist as you get into this stuff? Do you ever see a blending of like faith and science from your perspective?
I do actually. It's kind of all over the map, but it's kind of actually rare to get a glimpse into it, because it's JPL is a amazing place in a lot of ways. And it's also like unique within NASA. You know, you kind of think of NASA as, you know, pocket protectors and, you know, white shirts pretty conservative, straight-laced, maybe militaristic. Those are things that you think about traditionally. JPL very much is like a rogue actor. If you look at like the beginnings of JPL, like you'll find connections to like people like Frank Molina, who is in the McCarthy era with the Red Scare. You've got Jack Parsons, who's got ties to Aleister Crowley, you know, right. And like these were misfits that started this place, that were like experimenting with explosives for military contracts.
Yeah.
You know, and that were part of cults.
Right.
You know,
right.
So that's the beginning of JPL.
Yeah.
You know, and like in a lot of ways, the people at JPL in general, you know, right now, you know, there's always a change of the guard. You've got a lot of young people who are excited about space, a lot of, you know, for lack of a better word, millennials, people that are coming in with a lot of good technical knowledge and kind of a fresh face. But you got a lot of, old guard who are like, in a lot of ways, just like old hippies, man.
Right.
You know, they're like into space and they're listening to Dark Side of the Moon and they are different.
Yeah.
You know, so that's the culture in a lot of ways. That's a little window into the world. Can you remind me, did I actually answer your question? Oh, it was on faith. But it's a mix. You know, there's a lot of people, but we generally, things are kept very professional there. You don't hear about people talking about politics.
Right.
You don't hear people talking about religion. In a lot of ways, people are cognizant of, unfortunately, those are a lot of ways that people find divisions and they want to avoid those kind of conversations.
Yeah.
It's a little bit not part of the culture, I guess. You know?
That makes sense that you would keep it close. It also, it's cool to hear that. It makes me think of how almost, the philosophers like Camus and Sartre were kind of seen to be like misfits and rogue of the of the philosophy at the time. And it was because they were just the first to really try to teach like a godless philosophy in the world. And, it seems like the people who started JPL, I mean, if we saw anything in the last 4 years, it's the idea that you need a certain type to have forward thinking, right? To think of something that doesn't exist yet and actually try to set a course to get there would probably lend to some pretty creative and wacky people in a lot of ways, which is kind of cool.
Yeah. Yeah. And a lot of international effort, it's pretty amazing. You know, when I used to walk around lab, you know, now we've been closed obviously for a while and a lot of this stuff is remote. So there's not the community based anymore, but it's just amazing. JPL is essentially like a campus, right. And just to walk around and hear like the different languages and just, whether it's Asian or Iranian, there's a big mix of people and cultures, you know, there. So yeah, those are all positive things, you know, obviously. So.
Yeah. It's really cool.
Yeah.
I want to get your opinion on something really important. Okay.
Oh, all right.
Probably the most important thing we're going to talk about today, which is who is the best robot in movie history?
Best robot in movie history.
Or we can do like a top three, because I know this is tough. At first, I was like, oh, there's just a couple. And then I started going down the list. It's hard. So does anything come to mind, or would you like me to give you some options?
Well, no. I mean, I've got plenty of things coming to mind.
Okay.
But it's just like, you know, I think I can kind of answer this just straight off the cuff.
Yes.
You know, just as like, you know, what first comes into my mind.
Yeah.
You know, but like I could have my maybe more creative answer if I was like, if I tried to contemplate it a little bit more, sure. But I'm just not going to do it. I'm just going to go for it.
Yeah.
Like, for me, like Terminator.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, like I love that robot. It's just so fucking wicked.
We're talking T-800 or T-1000.
I'm talking T2, I think.
Right.
I think that's, I mean, I don't know, T1, man. Now we're talking about which movie is better in my mind, and I can't really do that. But yeah. Let's see. So that's one. I would say that definitely I would go with, R2-D2, sure. Obviously. Classic. Right. So cute. So classic. that just like comes right away. And the fact that he like was kind of like a, you know, a turret gunner on one of those, what is it, the Falcon 9 or whatever. Right. I don't know. It's just like dual
like kind
use,
of a badass,
man.
Too. Yeah.
Yeah. He's a badass and he's just this little cute thing. Okay, this one might be controversial, but I think, oh man, I'm trying to remember this movie, but was the girl from Weird Science a robot?
Ah, see, ooh. Now I'm glad you brought that up because I had come across a couple of things like RoboCop.
Oh,
and
yeah,
I was like,
yeah.
That's out because that's a cyborg. That's not a robot.
Okay. Yeah.
But Kelly McGillis in that film is a
Kelly LeBrock.
Oh, I'm sorry, Kelly. I got it confused with the woman from Top Gun. That she was essentially some early version of like a 3D printed woman. Right? So did she have robot parts on the inside? She probably had actual tissued organs and stuff in there.
Yeah. Totally. So it kind of feels like that's cheating.
A little.
You know, like you can't say that like, you know, the Million Dollar Man was a robot.
Right.
You know?
Right. Exactly.
He had augmented parts.
Like if you cut open T-1000, there's a robot under there.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
What about Johnny Five?
Johnny Five, I thought about about him immediately. Just because I don't know, Johnny Five for me is like he's kind of like the closest thing to the rovers that we're building. He's got the googly eyes and the mast and kind of is like shaped the same, you know? So he's got a cuteness, I think, there. You know, that you know, he's got tank treads rather than tires, but you know, you know. But but yeah, I mean, he's good. It, you know, for me, you know, I don't know if I'd put him in top three because he's for the kids, you know?
Right. He didn't really have like a real world application we really needed him for, right?
No, just to be cute AF. So yeah.
The other ones that came up on this list that we didn't mention were C-3PO, of course, the Iron Giant.
Iron Giant. What was that from?
It's an animated movie, I believe. Harry Connick Jr. plays a voice. It's really good. It'll make you cry at about 70 minutes. There's Chappie.
Oh yeah, Chappie. That's a good one.
We have Eve or Wally from Wally.
Mm-hmm.
Dot Matrix from Spaceballs. Joan Rivers.
Okay. Yeah,
she's good. That might be up there for me. Jinx from Space Camp, and also this is a good one, Bishop from Aliens.
Which
I thought was a solid creeper. You don't think of them as as a robot. So
I can't remember any of their names, but just on a robot movie level, do you remember there was a movie called Black Hole?
I don't.
It was actually put out by Disney. And it was kind of like a response to Star Wars.
Oh, really?
If you haven't seen it.
It's like an art film, right?
Yeah, it's really good. It holds up. And it's about like a rogue captain that just decides to send his like gigantic megalith of a ship into a black hole.
Right.
And, oh.
Like, and he goes totally rogue and insane. And it's really dark for a Disney movie. Wow.
I kind of remember like it. A Lawrence Fishburne movie from the 90s taking on a similar concept.
Yeah. But I can't remember any of the robots there, but that one's got some good ones too.
A good one. We'll check that out. Say It Tomorrow. I know you don't like to consider yourself a rock star in the scene, but I'm going to do it for you. If you got a call from like a big time action director and he gave you the keys to design a movie robot.
Yeah.
And here's going to be the application of the robot. Okay. I thought about this. It's going to be something that rebel Earth forces will be using to defend themselves in the year 2112. Little nod to Rush there. And then they will be fighting amorphous figures from another planet, but who are susceptible to human war machines, but only attack chemically. So what are you thinking for robot design? Like, what do we need here?
Well, first off, you're going to need something that's resistant to those chemicals.
Right.
You know, I mean, right off the bat. I guess we're going to need something. I'm not sure whether I'm the person for this job. I don't design war machines, actually. I've managed to steer clear of this in my career thus far, in spite of a lot of pulls.
Is that a pitfall that can easily happen in your career? Like, people just get kind of lulled into that side of the engineering?
The dark side?
When I was younger, I used to think of it more as a pitfall that I didn't want to, like, design lasers that were, like, you know, going to, like, be blowing up tanks and stuff like that, you know? You know, as I'm a little older, I just have a little bit different of a perspective on it where, I don't know, maybe I'm jaded, but it's just a little bit more acceptable. Like, let's face it, like, there's a lot of forces in this world that are bad and worse than the U.S. I know that the U.S. is not angels by any means, but God, it feels like we're the lesser of two evils in some cases. And there needs to be these people to kind of keep that power balance in check, you know? So I've changed a little philosophically, on it. And kind of, I would say I've gone more towards that end of the spectrum.
Right.
But at the same time, like, I feel like military industrial complex is out of control, you know, with the spending, you know, and this is my own personal opinion. Again, I'm not speaking on behalf of NASA or JPL.
Totally. Yeah, yeah.
You know,
of course.
This is just me talking. But, like, you know, granted, like, when we spend money on these things, a lot of it goes into the pockets of, you know, it's not actually like hard goods and things like that. These are like engineers and people. And, you know, so the military spending actually gets pumped back through the economy in a lot of ways, just as the NASA budget does. So that's a positive. But, like, you know, we just spent $50 billion on the next strategic bomber that's getting built out at Skunk Works in Lancaster, California.
Right.
You know, $50 billion.
It's insane.
Right?
Yeah.
And just to put that in perspective, like I know I'm a little skewed here, but like that is above the price tag for us to do a human mission to Mars. Right.
Wow.
And so like, what would you rather? We could put somebody and have a human presence there for that kind of money, you know? And granted, you know, $50 billion, you know, it can do a lot of good in a lot of other areas as well. You know, obviously, like, people, you know, people obviously want to, you know, talk about, like, you know, spending for you know, civil purposes and, you know, there's a lot of political things, but like, but I do want to say that, you know, that $50 billion, when you do put it into that stuff, it's not just like it goes down the drain. Like for a NASA mission, so little of it is actually physical materials, right? Mm-hmm. That we're buying. It's like really all like brain power and time and people's energy, you know, and that all goes into the economy and people's pockets, you know?
Is your mindset now of like kind of you know, that spending that much money investing in like essentially what, you know, what is like power brokering here on Earth. Do you think, you know, we're better suited sort of in that? I think I've heard Elon Musk talk about it, that we're, you know, better suited putting that money into space, into things like that, because that's the inevitable future.
Well, I think it's not an inevitable future. Right. I think, but what I think that resonates with me, that I think is Elon Musk belief. And even this is a, if this is a high off lofty goal, we've got to start somewhere. Right. And honestly, I don't think that there is anything that could prevent us from extinction besides for being, independent of Earth.
Wow. Okay.
So I think if we're going to be truly like a species that persists and has a longer history, that we will have to become unmarried to the Earth. And I'm like, I'm fully like an environmentalist, and you know, a lot of the work that I did early in my career was in Earth observing environmental satellites to do all the foundation of the science of global warming today.
Oh, wow.
was the stuff that I worked on, you know, in my 20s.
Interesting.
Yeah. And so I'm fully on board with that and saving this planet first, you know? But at the end of the day, like there are like shit happens, you know, and whether it's an asteroid or it's another virus,
right,
pandemic, you know what I mean? Like there will be something to kill us off.
I love, you know, the fact that we can like write hundreds of years of science books and tech and religious discourse and all these things. And it really comes down to two words, doesn't it? Shit happens, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Like we really, yep, don't have control over that.
So, yeah. Yeah. You don't. And I think that's the goal. I think it's to, I think it's just to be able to become independent and to diversify our habitability a little,
yeah,
bit, is something that's going to need to happen, you know?
But it's strange. It's like, you know, I hate to get political with this stuff, but you know, from a layman's point of view, which is mine, you know, I see like news stories about Space Force. I see, you know, China and the US kind of vying for different positions on the moon, space junk, you know, falling from the sky. So it seems like there's even already a kind of strong political element to space. Like, is that, are we just in that kind of pitfall where we're sort of going to repeat the issues we had here on Earth up there?
Yeah, I think definitely that's going to be an ongoing thing. I think that I actually just recently read a book. It was called, it's The Next 100 Years.
Okay.
And I'm trying to remember the author, and, it's by this, basically US government, a strategic guy that does like long-term strategy and trend, global trends. And without a doubt, our space presence is going to be like, will either cement or ensure the demise of American superiority of, you know, of basically the seaways and everything that makes like America kind of the, you know, the major power. Basically like pretty soon, you know, what the forecast was, is what's going to happen is you're not just going to have communication and reconnaissance. You know, there's, and there already is, I'm sure, but there, you know, there's weaponization and being able to take out targets, you know, in a moment's notice, with space-borne weapons. And then even something that was really interesting to me that was forecast to become on the horizon is with the advent of increased battery technologies, lithium ion, increased capacities, and then also with the ability to transmit charge remotely, right? Through microwave energy.
Right.
So much of military presence and everything is an infrastructure line, whether it be gasoline, all the supplies that you need.
Right.
But what you're going to have is you're going to have like, you're basically going to have these military components that are going to be able to move much more freely and are going to be able to charge with space-based solar arrays and things like that. And the military superiority is going to have a lot to do with that power transmission and who controls that what that's going to do for strategy. Anyhow, this was all out of this book, The Next 100 Years.
Yeah.
And it is not like anything to do with NASA or any official mind.
Sure, sure.
You know, this is just something that I thought was really interesting and kind of tied into your original question on whether these problems will persist. And I think it's human nature. But competition, you could say, is good in some ways. A lot of times this stuff will drive us
right
to innovation.
I mean, that's how we got to the moon, was competition with Russia, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So it's nefarious. The motives are questionable, but the end result isn't all bad sometimes because of it.
That's really cool, man. I mean, or not cool. I don't know. It's interesting nonetheless.
It's interesting.
It's certainly interesting. Yeah. So I want to backtrack about something, because there's something I wanted to make sure I talked to you about prior to losing you today. We talked about it before. I even went ahead. I do a segment on the show called Mystery Friend. And I was a little shocked about like how few people from the Dilemma days I talk to anymore. So I actually dug up your old physics lab partner, Kevin Bannon. And which I'm sure you know. And he wrote something about you saying, "I just remember how funny it was watching all the jocks and normies try to figure him out. Like this kid with huge ripped pants, a pooch shirt, and dirty mop of hair is actually a whiz kid and super chill. They couldn't compute." Which is, again, you know, we mentioned it before, as part of my recollection of you as well. And then, you know, you sort of coupled it with me remembering that we played in the living room of your parents' house, and that your parents' house was kind of that was like the safe place that we could all go chill. Like we had basically an open door there. The pantry was open to us. I never got yelled at for anything. There is a bunch of people chilling there all the time. I think we almost got caught smoking weed on the deck, like all sorts of stuff. Now, as a parent, you know, I was really wondering like what your parents' philosophy was and like how the environment they set up, how beneficial it was for you and how intentional it was to create an environment like that.
Yeah, I've kind of talked to him about this a little bit. You know, it's definitely interesting. I don't know whether I would have the patience just thinking of all the shit that we put them through, you know? But I think it's, you know, this kind of goes to this world and, you know, and how things have changed. But like, you know, I guess the term for it really these days is, you know, free range kids.
Right.
You know? And yeah, they were just incredibly, you know, not really, they allowed us to be kids, right? And to make mistakes, you know? And even from a very early age, I'm just like, man, I was like, Mom, did you really just like let me go at 8 just to run around, you know, on my skateboard and my bike? And I was coming home at like 10 and 11 o'clock, and she's like, yeah, you know, like, and you know, it's like, we play like, you know, flashlight tag, like till late. And, you know, it's like, and they were always pretty, you know, strict about the schoolwork component.
Right.
Me having to do well there.
Sure.
And that was where they drew the line. But yeah, I mean, the philosophy really was, you know, according to my mom, was just to, just to really, you know, just to let us be kids and not to have to encumber me with chores and just other kind of overhead there. So
was there any like avenue that you pushed that was like just a little too much for them?
Oh God. Yeah. Dude. I mean, let's face, I mean, kid, I was such a I was a horrible kid in a lot of ways, you know what I mean? And this is why, you know, there's no right way to parent, right. You know, it's just like, what do you get, you know, but like, you know, if I can remember back, like, do you remember like Not a Bono?
No.
Does that ring a bell?
I don't think so.
She lived like three houses down from me. She was like 3 years older than us. Okay. And like when she was nine, she used to ride this bicycle with like a banana seat and, you know, like the things coming down off the handlebars,
tassels.
Like the little streamels.
Yeah.
So like there was one day we always used to make fun of her because of her name. And, dude, we found, like, I remember this, like I was like six and we found like a red used condom with ticklers on the side. Oh. And we flagged her down and I was like, hey, Nada, do you want to try out the latest handle grip?
Oh, and no. She's,
yeah. And dude, I remember picking it up and threading the tassels into this condom and we put it on her handle grip and she rode around for like 3 days just gripping this used condom.
Oh man.
Dude, when her dad found out what happened, like shit hit the fan. And that's just like one story. Like I remember like I had another like Dave Wax. We were playing football with him and I didn't like call. I grabbed like a crescent wrench out of my dad's tool chest and just started breaking every window in their house that I could find.
Oh, I kind of remember that.
Do you remember that?
That actually rings a bell. Yeah. I mean, that kid was rough.
Yeah.
Cause he later in life, he also tried to sell us green crayon shavings, pretending it was weed.
Yeah. So always, good for him.
Not even dark green. It was like, it was very light green. I was like, come on, guys.
That's pretty funny.
So that's where like, so there was discipline and there was like, you know, you going a little too far. You had to reel it back at some point.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, I don't know what I would have done.
Cause I remember you taking your dad's car too.
Oh yeah. I mean, I would.
And
I
you
would
were not out. Old. You were like, what? 14, 15?
14. Yeah, yeah. I was taking my dad. My dad had a sports car and, you know, my dad did okay for himself, you know, like it's one of the things that I'm proud of. You know, he was able to afford, a sports car that we bought when I was six and I kept it until when he gave it to me until I was like 32 and I sold it, for another reason. But, which is tough, but yeah, yeah. So we had this sports car and, you know, I was taking this thing out when I was like 14 years old and luckily I just never binned it. But I got close. You're just a teenager doing stupid shit.
Yeah.
It was a lot of fun.
Were you actually allowed, I know you had all the dirt bikes and stuff too. Were you actually like allowed to cruise on those like willy nilly like that? Or was that also stealing them and taking them out of the house?
No, I mean, I had one dirt bike. I didn't have multiple. And dude, that was a crazy story. I was like wishing upon a star when I was five. Eventually I just stopped eating lunch and saving my lunch money.
Right.
And my dad said, if I could get together $1,000 working like my that he would get me and he would split it and get me the dirt bike. And so I eventually got it. And the rule was that I had to push it to Green Acres. And not ride it on the road. So I would have to, kind of slyly, you know, hide some of the road usage of that to get to places. But that was crazy because, you know, that was another thing. We had like a gang of dirt bikers in our neighborhood.
Right.
And this is like super suburban. Like there's like practically no greenery and the cops would just follow us. They would try and catch us so hard, but you just can't catch anybody on a dirt bike because there's no rules. You know, you're like going in between houses, jumping curbs. Like, you know, it's impossible.
That's so
fun.
Yeah, and if people could only visualize the type of neighborhood this was that you guys are outrunning the cops, it's hilarious.
Yeah.
So I know you're like a, you know, did you ever, when you were that age, like have an aversion to speed at all? Or was it just like the second you got on one of those things, you really just had no fear?
Oh, I mean, of course everybody has fear,
right?
You know, dude, I got spanked and I got the wind knocked out of me so many times,
you know,
where I couldn't breathe. And,
sure.
you know, it's like, no, I mean, to say there was no fear is ridiculous. I've just been doing it for so long, you know, both motorcycles and just like, whether you're on a skateboard or whatever it is, you learn to manage the margins, right?
Right.
And to take calculated risks.
Well, I feel like you're managing the margins so much more thinly as you get older, where like, I mean, you go from like now into super bike racing and mountain climbing, and you're not old, you know, you still have a lot of years ahead of you. Like, do you feel like the older you get, you need just like a little bit more to feel that thing you felt like on the dirt bike? Like, does it just take a little more? Or do you have to have that fear, that knowledge that, you know, one, you know, wrong move and you could die or something? Like, is that part of the thrill?
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely part of the thrill. I feel like this is like, now I'm turning into like this, like Point Break cheesy shit.
Wow, you're a lot of things, like, dude.
Yeah, I know. So I don't want to get, dude, you know, it's just being right on the edge, you know, Razor, just got to live there. Like, I don't know, Ben.
But there's something to it. I mean, that movie Free Solo I just watched with the...
Oh, yeah, Alex Honnold.
Yeah. And, you know, that guy is like his... it's not just physically what he's doing. I thought the most fascinating thing about that documentary was his philosophy on life and death. And like, do you think just you share like any of that getting to the age you've gotten to now?
I think so. I mean, I'm quite a bit older than him. I mean, I'm 41 now and you know, and I can't, and my mom can't believe I have survived to this point intact. But like, I do think that there, you know, everybody gets chilled out a little bit. Like when I was 24 and 23 and like, you know, living up in, you know, and being a snowboard bum and,
right.
and
yeah.
you know, in like working as a bellhop, like, and early in my motorcycle racing career, I took way more risks, you know, and I'm, you know, I think everybody gets to that point where it's just not worth it. It's like, you're looking at it then as like a potential career path and you've got like something to prove, right? And it's like, and now, it's like, I'm just trying to have fun and like live with myself, you know, and like, and that pushes me pretty hard, right? To go hard. But like, it, you know, it's like, I don't have anything to prove anymore and I just want to keep doing it. So I'm not willing to take the risks that are going to cause me to not be able to do it, you know, because of an accident.
Right. So it's really just about completing the task and finding your personal joy now.
Yeah. And, you know, like when I say be happy with myself, that also includes, you know, like being happy with my performance and feeling like I'm making progress, you know, in certain areas, you know, so.
Can you still get real, like if you just have an off day on the track or off day climbing or something, do you get real down on yourself?
I do. I do put a lot of pressure on myself there, you know, it's like, so yeah, I mean, it's, you know, I'm just doing it for fun, but like, it's still in the back of my mind, like where, you know, if I know that, you know, that it's, I'm just going to go, you know, but it, you know, it's, I'm still having fun. It's like, you know, smallest violin playing. It's like, you know, I'm not throwing a temper tantrum or anything like that, but it's just going to push me next time, you know, to try and be better, you know.
It's the mind of the engineer, right?
Yeah, for better, for worse, man. You know, it's like definitely I have a lot of an analytical component and you know, to my brain and the way it works. And I feel like in a lot of ways, like this job has like pushed me more towards that direction. And you know, it's something that I don't like necessarily. It's like, my God, like I'm so, you know, doing this line of work, it pushes your brain, it pushes your mannerisms and your tendencies towards a very, I don't know, robotic existence for, you know, for another, you know, I mean, so it's got good things and bad things associated with it, but it's just like, I'm really trying to manage and like stay, you know, just stay not so engineering.
Right. Yeah. That makes sense.
Got to be a kid still.
Yeah. Like what's, so that being said, like what's in store for you, do you think? I know, you know, the perseverance, right, is collecting samples that need to be picked up, correct? So
that's right.
Are you, you know, already in the engineering process of that, you know, the next, mission to go get those samples?
Yeah, so that is, that's in the works. And right now I'm slated to be on Perseverance through our first sample collection that is happening. It's basically a baseline for end of June, July timeframe. And then once that happens, then I'll start transitioning to another project. And right now I'm trying to decide between two options. There's a mission that's coming up a little sooner. That's called Europa Clipper, and that is that's a probe, a satellite that we're sending out to Jupiter's moon Europa. That's a very interesting moon, and there's a role there for me if I want to take it. And then the other option is to go to SRL, which is a sample return lander, and then work on the robotic arm. And work with some suppliers as well out in a place called Leonardo, which is a robotics company in Rome, Italy.
Oh, wow.
And that would be pretty fun because it would involve a little bit of travel a couple times a year. Yeah. So I'm trying to decide between those two options.
Wait, Brad, Jupiter came up. Give me the question real quick.
Can you design a robot that's meant to go to Jupiter?
Oh, it's a good question.
So that's from my son, Zeke. So I let him, every once in a while, I asked him, I told him I'm speaking to a friend of mine today who builds robots that go to space. What do you guys want to ask him?
Yeah.
And that's what he wanted to ask you. And I was kind of curious too, because so it actually just came up. I'm shocked. So we're really going to Jupiter, huh?
Yeah, we're going to Jupiter, and you—it's a little bit. You could really think of a satellite as a robot. Oh. You know, it might not have like a head, you know, but it's got eyes, and it's got mechanical functions, and in a lot of ways, a satellite is a robot.
That's true,
in every sense of the word. Huh. And so, so yes, we're building a robot to go to Jupiter. If it would be something that you would think of as a robot as looking like the Mars rover or the, or like Wall-E or, you know, any robot that you imagine in the movies, that wouldn't really work on Jupiter because it's a gaseous giant and there's no surface.
Right.
So that kind of robot would go to Jupiter and would go to the one of the moons that's solid there.
Got you. And when do you think a person is actually going to be able to set foot on Mars? Do you have to build something prior to be able to, you know, house a human, like a Total Recall dome?
Yes. Okay. So one of the things people don't realize when we say about going to Mars is it's not like going to the moon in that you can just go there and then just blast off and come back. Like, planetary alignment dictates a certain timing that is very long. So when you go, A, it takes 8 months to get there.
Right.
B, once you get there, I can't remember the exact months, but you have to wait there for the planets to align again. And you're talking about like, I want to say 5 to 8 months and then an 8 month return.
Oh my
so,
goodness. Okay.
So it's not like you can just go and come back,
right?
You know, and like that's at least that's not the mission profiles that, you know, that anybody's looking at right now, because you just don't have the fuel to be able to do it. Anything's possible if you have unlimited fuel, but that's just it's not possible essentially. So so there's a lot of stepping stones, Ben. There's I know that there's folks out there that are making some pretty wild claims about how fast we can do it.
Yeah.
And if I had to guess, and this is me, not NASA or JPL or anything else, I think if we maintain a pretty aggressive program and we're that's funded and where as currently NASA has, that's the main mission, you know, is to get to Mars. But we're going to get to the moon first to help qualify the technology.
Right.
You know, I'm thinking if I had to guess that we're talking 2035, 2040.
Wow. That is not far away.
It's not when you think of it, because, you know, we're already 2021 here.
That means my kids could be the first to go to Mars.
Yep.
So, okay. Yep. So sign them up for space camp now.
Yeah, man.
Done.
Yeah. Yep. I don't know if I would volunteer that for your kids. But,
not for the first one?
Yeah.
All right. I'll wait till like 2043 for like round two or something.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
Listen, if I have a son or daughter in their 20s who are, you know, have the mental and physical fortitude to be the people who would even be considered to go to Mars, I have a feeling old pops, old retired crinky drummer is not going to be able to convince them otherwise, you know?
Be surprised, man. Be surprised.
Yeah. I hope I still have some juice then. But
yeah.
Torsten, we've had you for 90 minutes, man. Thanks so much for coming on the podcast. I had so much fun catching up.
Indeed. Yeah, guys, it was great to catch up. It was fun, and I hope that you guys got some good material, good takeaways.
It's fascinating. Thanks, Torsten. Make sure you wear a helmet out there.
All right, Ben. Take care, man.
Wow. Houston, we don't have a problem.
Brad, I feel small.
Oh, good.
I feel infinitesimally small right
like
now.
Like a tiny blue dot.
Like a tiny blue dot.
Dude, yeah. I thought it was hilarious that he basically was the guy in the beginning there where he's talking about when you asked him like whether his kind of hands-on gave him insight. And he basically was saying that he was that guy in the movie that pushes the fucking jet past the red line. Like, that's what he was saying. He's like,
you're right.
He's like, you know, I have the, you know, he was Kirk telling Scotty, now give me more power. She can't take it, Jim. She can't take it. And he's like, no, I know we can go a little bit further.
They've gone to Plaid.
That's exactly what he was basically saying. Yeah. It's like, I know that this piece of metal can take more punishment than what these computer guys are telling me.
Yeah. He's like the Steve Buscemi of like JPL.
give me more. God.
Yeah, you're so right. That's true. Funny, well, it's true though. I mean, I think what we were talking about, it's big. Like you need a little bit of like badass and kind of like forward thinking psychopath to do this stuff, right?
And just the more that you meet like real people who have interesting, you realize that like, you know what? Movies are not that outrageous. There's a lot of incredible people that are doing, like, he's literally that guy. You know, you watch that action movie and you're like, no way, man. Nobody would ever push a plane past the point that it's, you know, it would come apart, you know? But he's literally saying that that's exactly what he does.
Yeah. So if I trust anyone to take us into the black hole, it's Torsten. Yeah, right. No, you're totally right. It is, like, intense. And I feel like, just as you go and go, you know, because I was thinking about it in my scale and I'm like, all right, so you spend, you know, he laid it all out for us, you know, like how long it takes from the point of like inception and research and design to like get these things together. And then all these tiny little components come together in this final piece and you send it up. Like that must be such a rush of adrenaline every time, like it goes up, it comes down, it makes a move, you know, like hanging on the edge of your seat.
Yeah.
And I could see like the same way, like a musician gets accustomed to, you know, playing music and this high rush of ups and downs, how someone in his position could take on, you know, what is it? Super bike riding and and mountain climbing and things that would give you like a
adrenaline rush,
a similar adrenaline rush. Yeah. Yeah. It's really intense, man.
It's funny. It's really
funny. I don't think I'm like you. I mean, now it's different with kids, but I'd kind of be interested to go to space.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like I don't have like, you know, I don't feel like dedicating my life to it, but like,
oh, don't get me wrong. If I could get a first class ticket on the shuttle and go, you know, after it's been well vetted for safety, I would love to go up and spend a couple days in the space station for sure.
So you're like, so you're ready when there's like spacecations.
Yes.
So you're like the glamping of space travel. Yeah.
I don't need to dedicate like, you know, 15 years of my life to get, you know, to go into outer space on a sketchy rocket that like has a, you know, a 1 in 50 chance of blowing up.
I feel like it's different now too. I mean, you know, I remember the story of not Neil Armstrong and not Buzz Aldrin, the other guy who I always forget his name, I'm afraid. But, you know, he was known for taking like what maybe he might have been the loneliest man in the world once.
Right.
Because he was on like the dark side of the moon by himself.
Exactly.
You know, like that is some crazy, crazy exploring, you know, that's like, it's bold. It's bold, Brad.
It is. It's very bold. I mean, those machines were really, you know, they were not, you know, what do they say that the, all the computers on that freaking, on that, that first lunar landing trip, you know, were infinitesimal compared to what's in your iPhone right now.
Sure. I mean, but the point I was making with the man being alone on the other side is like, now I literally follow astronauts on Instagram.
Oh yeah.
Who are literally like sending videos of how they're like attempting to make a pizza on Friday and like anti-gravity, like up on their spaceship. You know?
I guess maybe it is cushy enough now that I could go.
Yeah, it's like, that's what I'm saying. It's getting there where like, you know, even like, you know, what Neil Armstrong and them did was like touring before cell phones, you know, like they were actually out there. You know, all you were getting was this little audio back. You didn't know what was going on yet. And now you got live feeds from space, you know?
Right.
Like you could become a social media celebrity from the moon if you wanted to.
True that.
So I think it's time. I think it's time. This is how I raise my Instagram followers. Well, anyway, that was super fun. I'm really thankful to Torsten for putting up with my bad drum playing. for our youth and staying a friend of mine and giving us all that great information. That was so fucking rad, man.
Yeah, great combo and, for sure.
And I like what he said early on. I think people should take a clue from that these days, you know? Just fucking focus for like 10 minutes, people. Like, you know, don't just watch the YouTube for 30 seconds. Read the damn manual, you know?
Yeah.
I really believe in it. And, you know, if you want a precursor to it from someone, you know, very successful, take it from him, you know?
Absolutely.
Let's get out of here.
All right. We'll see you next week.
All right. Love you.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices.
Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.